is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hey, Hoopheads, I wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Coach Dan DeCrane from Gilmore Academy, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Fast Draw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball. If you're looking to improve your coaching, please consider joining the Hoopheads Mentorship Program. We believe that having a mentor is the best way to maximize your potential and become a transformational coach. By matching you up with one of our experienced mentors, you'll develop a one-on-one relationship that will help your coaching, your team, your program, and your mindset. The Hoopheads Mentorship Program delivers mentoring services to basketball coaches at all levels through our team of experienced head coaches. Find out more at hoopheadspod.com or shoot me an email directly, mike@hoopheadspod.com. Follow us on social media at hoopheadspod on Twitter and Instagram, and be sure to check out the Hoopheads Podcast Network for more great basketball content. Coaches, do you have a point guard or leader you're going to be counting on next season to run the show for you? Don't leave next season to chance. Thousands of coaches send their players to a point guard college camp each summer to learn to think the game, lead a team, and run the show. Your players will be smarter, better leaders, and better equipped to foster a championship culture next season in practice and in your locker room. I've seen firsthand how PGC camps have had a huge impact on players and coaches that I know, both on and off the court. You can go to pgcbasketball.com to find a 5-day, 4-night camp near you. That's pgcbasketball.com. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads Podcast. It's Mike Klintzing here with my co-host, Jason Sunkel. Welcome back from baby duty.
Listen, I haven't seen you
in a while.
Well, it's been a week. We did an episode a week ago.
No, I mean our NBA, but our regularly scheduled episodes, I feel like I'm checked out, man. I'm cornering the market on. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads Podcast. It's Mike Klintzing here without my co-host, Jason Sunkel. I feel like that's going to become my tagline.
I will say, apparently my students are listening to our coaching episodes because they've been noticing. They're like, why aren't you on the coaching episodes anymore? And I'm like,
all right, that's good. There's people listening. So, it's good. There's people out there listening. Good to know. Even if it's only your students.
Yeah. Well, listen, they're listening. They find our episodes entertaining. So that's all I'm going to say.
That's good.
All right, so
second round of the NBA playoffs, but you're going to regale us with some trivia first.
Yeah, here we go. Luka Doncic yesterday was the first youngest player with 45 points and 10 rebounds in a playoff game since this player in 2001.
45 and 10 rebounds.
Yep, youngest player since this player in 2001. So you got to think about who was young in 2001, Mike.
2001. That would have to be, well, my first thought is Tim Duncan, but Tim Duncan came into the league at age 22 in 99, maybe. Was that his first year?
Yeah, 99. Yep.
So Duncan does not qualify. Kobe was in that same draft. Could Kobe have been a 45 and 10 guy? I'm going to go
Kobe. Ding, ding, ding. Ding, ding, ding. Good job, Mike. Okay, go on.
All right. That's one. I'm one for one. I'm one for one.
You're going to like this next one. The 76ers shot 0 for 10 from three-point off of passes from James Harden. That was tied for the worst three-point shooting player off of players' passes in the last eight playoffs. This team shot 0 for 10 from passes from a player against the Cavs in 2016. What player did they shoot 0 for 10 from? And I'll give you a hint. It's a Celtic. And it wasn't. Their Celtic's not on the team anymore.
This is in what year?
2016.
Well, let me think. Who would have been making that many passes on the Celtics? I got to go back to... I should know this one probably is obvious, but...
It is very obvious.
I'm drawing a blank as to who...
He also was a member of the Cavaliers a few years later. But it didn't work out. Didn't work out.
Didn't work out. Oh, Isaiah Thomas.
There you go. Isaiah Thomas. There you go. Okay.
Thanks. Yeah. I only get half credit for that.
Yeah. Ja Morant and Jaren Jackson Jr. are the second duo age 22 or younger in a playoff game with 30 points. Who's the other player in the same game, that is? Who's the other set of duo 22 and younger that have each scored 30 points in a game?
In the same game.
Same game.
Playoff game.
Playoff game.
22 and under duo. So I'm guessing.
It's relatively recent.
Relatively recent.
Well, I shouldn't say relatively recent. I would say.
LeBron and.
No. 22 and under. Come on, who was he going to score? When he was 22, he didn't have anyone on his team.
Darius Miles didn't get 30 in a playoff game?
Did Darius Miles play in a playoff game with the Cavs? I don't think so.
He may not have. Let's see.
I would say it's close to the same. It's like a few years after what you're thinking, but...
22 and under.
Neither of these players are on the team that they were on, but they're both still in the league.
I have nothing. I don't even know where to begin.
Durant and Westbrook.
Okay.
They did it three times.
Okay.
All right.
Makes sense.
The last one, Mike. This isn't referring to tonight's game. This is referring to the previous game. Giannis Antetokounmpo had a triple-double. Okay. Only two other Bucks have ever had a triple-double in the playoffs. Who are the two Bucks that have a triple-double in the playoffs? One's obvious, one's not.
One is obvious. So are we thinking about somebody, is it somebody from this current era that's one?
No, neither of them are from this current era.
Neither are of this current era. Kareem.
Kareem is one.
Oscar Robertson?
No. I said one was obvious. That would have been the other. That would have been obvious.
Seems like Big O is the king of the triple-double, so it seemed like he might have to be. So this one is not obvious. Wait, don't give me anything.
Okay.
So my next guest would be Sidney Moncrief?
Nope.
Glenn Big Dog Robinson?
No.
Ray Allen?
No. I'm going to look and see what year this guy played, Mike.
Sam Cassell?
I don't know. He is not as old as I would have expected.
Junior Bridgman?
He played from 82. He played in my lifetime. He played from 82 to 93.
Paul Pressey.
There it is. Paul Pressey. Yeah, there you go.
All right.
I have to say that I don't know that I ever heard that name before.
No? Okay. Took me a second to kind of go through the 80s Bucks, but once Paul Pressey popped into my head, I knew it instantly.
Yeah, he did it one time. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar did it one time. Giannis is the only Buck to ever get it two times. So there you go, Mike.
Really, really good, really good defender, known as sort of a well-rounded, not great at any one thing in particular, but just probably in today's game would be a 3-and-D guy. Although I don't know that he shot from the outside back in his era, but definitely would have been a guy.
He got a triple-double.
kind of a Swiss Army knife kind of player.
Yeah. All right, so we're going to start with that earlier series tonight, Mike, the Bucks-Celtics. I will say, like, my reaction to the first game was, man, I don't know if the Celtics are going to, like, compete at all in this series. They just – that they were doing – the Bucks were doing such a great job defending Tatum. They basically were doing to Tatum what the Celtics were doing to Durant, right? I mean, that's what it looked like in game one. They attacked him. They forced him to take tough shots. They made him feel uncomfortable. Then the Celtics returned the favor to Giannis tonight. I mean, they returned the favor to Giannis tonight.
They did the same thing to Giannis though in game one. When you think that, I don't know, what did he end up shooting tonight? He was 9 of 25 in game one. I forget what he was tonight, but it was fairly similar. Let me take a look and see exactly where he was at.
He was 11 of 27.
11 of 27. So
look at the first half, he was 2 of 11 at the end of the first half. So
they were making it tough on him without question.
Yeah.
And putting a lot of bodies in front of him. But the difference in this game came down to
Jaylen Brown?
No. Threes, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Boston 20 of 43. So they score 60 points from the 3-point line. The Bucks 3 of 18, they score 9. So I think they flashed up a graphic during the game that the largest difference or the largest margin of difference from one team to another in 3-pointers, I think it was Golden State had a 54-point difference. Might have been in 2016. And so tonight,
oh, what happened at the end of that season?
tonight the Bucks got outscored. Yeah, the Bucks got outscored by 51 from the 3-point line. So you can say, boil it down, it's a make or miss league, I guess. If Boston's going to shoot like that, then Milwaukee has no chance. Conversely, if you flip those numbers around, Boston has no chance. So everything looks better or worse depending on how those shots go in. In game one for Boston, those same shots didn't go in. And once those shots start going in, then it just loosens up slightly the defense that you were talking about against Tatum and Brown, where suddenly now guys are maybe taking another half step or they're leaning a little bit more towards the shooter because they want to get out there because the Celtics are hitting a bunch of threes. And that just opens up just another sliver of a driving lane so Tatum or Brown can get in there and get a shot off. So I think when you look at what Milwaukee's tried to do all season defensively, they were number one in the league in the amount of three-pointers allowed. And that's kind of by design. Like, they want teams to take shots. And if you go back and you listen to what people were saying heading into game one, a lot of people were talking about the fact that the Bucks are going to sit back and they're going to do what they normally do. They're going to wall off the lane because, especially when they play their big Portis, Lopez, Giannis lineup, you're basically walling off the paint and you're just saying to teams, go ahead, try to make threes. Grant Williams, Al Horford, Peyton Pritchard.
Go for it.
Marcus Smart, go for it. Shoot as many threes as you want. And in game one, those threes didn't go in. In game two, they went in at a huge, huge clip. The reality is probably somewhere in between. Boston's probably not going to shoot as poorly as they did in game one. And I'm guessing they're probably not going to make 23s in a game for the rest of the series. So the truth probably lies somewhere in between. In game one, as you said, when you watch that game, you came away from it going, whew, how's Boston ever going to compete with Milwaukee? Then you come into game two, Smart's out, and it feels like, all right, Milwaukee's going to take care of this, and this series is going to be effectively over if they do what they did in game one to Boston in game two. And instead, the Celtics come out, they shoot the lights out, they make it really tough on Giannis, and other guys for the Bucks just didn't step up. Jrue Holiday wasn't nearly as good as he was in game one. And without Middleton, you're going to need an A effort from Jrue Holiday. And he wasn't terrible tonight, but he also wasn't as good as they needed him to be. And clearly, as you said, Boston is walling off the paint on Giannis as much as humanly possible. Now, he's still Euro steps his way into layups. He still is overpowering guys in the post. He's still making a lot of great passes and kickouts, but they're making it really difficult on him. And so for Milwaukee, if you want to get Giannis going, you got to get out on the fast break. But when Boston's banging home 46% of their threes, your opportunity to rebound and get out and run is pretty small. And I think that's something that was a challenge. Boston only turned it over 11 times tonight. So Milwaukee just wasn't able to get out on the break the way they were in game one and get guys easy baskets. And so I think when I look ahead to the rest of the series, obviously you're going back to Milwaukee. The Bucks sit with having stole one in Boston. And so I think the key moving forward to me is how well does Boston shoot threes, because that impacts not only Boston's ability to score and what they do offensively, but it also, if they're missing, it also opens up Milwaukee's transition game, which I think is an important part of it. They're offensively the Bucks' biggest weakness over the course of their history, and they started to correct it a little bit last year in their finals run, is their half-court offense. And their half-court offense can get a little stagnant. Giannis, as much as I think he's better than he's ever been, and he's got a wider arsenal of shots that he can go to, but he still doesn't have the same, like, I just give him the ball and get out of the way and he's going to get me a great shot every single time. He still has to labor sometimes to get those shots, and he's passing the ball much better. But I still think
he was supremely lucky tonight too. There were multiple times and Stan Van Gundy talked about it. He basically barreled over a guy and they didn't call a foul on him. Right. You know what?
Yeah.
Like
it's almost right.
He's got to be careful. He's got to be careful.
Yeah. He's approaching Shaq's treatment in terms of, I think when he's in there and he's not as big as Shaq, especially later in his career, Shaq, but if you look at rookie year Shaq, he's not that far off from what rookie Shaq looked like. And I just think he's a guy, when I watch him, like trying to officiate Giannis and figure out, is he there? Is the defender there? When he's taking his two giant long strides, he's at the top of the key and it's one dribble, and then he's got two big long Euro step strides and he's going side to side and getting to the basket and he's leaning with his elbow and his arms like 8 feet long and the defender's trying to get there. I just don't know how you officiate that. And then on the post-ups, he's banging, and then he turns. And he's definitely, when you talk about him in the post, he's much more of a power player than he is a finesse player. He's not pulling out the Hakeem dream shake and that kind of footwork. He's just basically, I'm going to back you down and get where I want to go because I'm stronger than you and I'm longer than you, and that's going to allow me to get the kind of shot I want. And so I think he's pretty difficult to officiate. And so that could be a key going forward too, is how are those interior plays in the post, how are they officiated? And if Giannis picks up an offensive foul or two, that suddenly changes the tenor of the game, and you could have Giannis sitting for stretches, which has happened to him in the past. So
yeah, speaking of people that are sitting for stretches, Mike, I'm out. Are you?
You're out on Jaren Jackson.
We're currently recording at midnight, and it's the fourth quarter of the Golden State Memphis game. Jaren Jackson Jr. just fouled out of the game, Mike. I'm out. Listen, he is a great defensive player, but I am not comfortable putting him up there with elite defensive players if all he's going to do is constantly foul out. He cannot stay on the floor. It's absolutely ridiculous.
Well, it's sad because his team clearly needs him, and they're so much better when he's on the floor, both offensively and defensively, just because of the spacing that he can provide on offense as a guy who's 6'11 or 7 feet tall, and then his ability to protect the rim and move his feet out on the perimeter. But he picks up a lot of silly fouls that, if he's going to really progress into the player that Memphis hopes he can be, he's going to have to eliminate that fouls. Now, the good news is, going back to your trivia question, he's 22 years old. So he still has the ability to hopefully be able to figure that out and stay on the floor. But it's kind of amazing. That's one of those things in the game of basketball when you think about players, that there are some guys who offensively just know how to use their body and draw fouls. And I don't think it's something that you can teach. I don't think it's something where you can watch film and watch a guy do it and try to emulate that. There's just some guys that have a knack for being able to draw fouls. And then I think on the other end of it, there's just some guys who defensively, whatever it is, they're a step slow, they're a little bit awkward, they do something different, that just have a tendency to have fouls called on them. And Jaren Jackson just seems like he's a guy who attracts fouls no matter where he goes. And as I said, I think Memphis needs him on the floor for a lot of reasons on both ends of the court.
I just watch Mobley play defense, and I know Mobley's a rookie, and Jackson, this is his third year, right? But I just feel like I feel more comfortable and confident that Mobley's going to be.
Oh, for sure.
I mean, just because, I mean, how many times did Mobley foul out at all this year? Like maybe, I feel like there was one game that he maybe fouled out because he was in foul trouble early in the game. And then like Bickerstaff rolled the dice with him, like in the fourth quarter or something. I feel like he fouled out at one game, but like there was never a point in the season I was like, man, he commits really dumb fouls.
No, he doesn't. It's amazing for a guy who is as good at blocking shots as Mobley is, the amount of times that he just comes over to help and goes straight up and just impacts the shot with his length and doesn't try to block or swing down. It's a guy who kind of understands what he can and can't do, when he can block a shot and when he's better off just trying to go straight up and alter it, or just try to be in the vicinity to alter the shot. And for Mobley to be able to do that, we've talked about it a bunch of times, but for Mobley to be able to do that as a rookie, yeah, I think defensively his ceiling, just because of his ability to avoid fouling, makes him more valuable at this point than Jaren Jackson. It's still early for Jaren Jackson. I know he's been in the league a few years, but there's still.
And he was also injured a lot the first year, right?
Yeah, so last year he missed almost the entire season. I just hope that he's able to eventually figure it out, because when you look at what Memphis can be and what their ceiling is, and they're up one with a minute 37 to go, but they need – Jaren Jackson has to be a part of it.
Oh, and man, you're ahead of me. I got to do my cast here and put it on my iPad. I think the cast is slowing me down.
Well, I won't say anything. I won't say anything else.
That's all right.
I won't say anything. Ja's getting it done. I'll just say that. How about that?
Now I see. Yeah, I just saw the. Yeah. So he's playing incredibly. As is I mean, Steph's looked. Listen. Okay. So we've talked about Memphis. Let's talk about the Warriors. And I know, you know, we're gonna have to, like, once the game's over, kind of look at like this on what does it mean scale. But I mean, I know you and I have talked. And you despise the Warriors. You can't root for the Warriors. But just watching their ball movement is just – it is beautiful to watch, whether we like the team or not.
I like them a lot better when the stakes are low. I enjoy watching them in the regular season. And they do play a beautiful style of basketball. And I've said it hundreds of times before the Cavs went up against the Warriors in the four straight finals back in 2012, 2013. I loved watching Steph just because of his footwork and the ball movement. He does everything that you would want a basketball player to do. He's not just a guy who plays with the ball in his hands. He's a guy who moves without the ball, makes his teammates better with that movement. And yeah, Golden State plays a tremendous brand of basketball. As a Cavs fan and going through those situations, I just have a hard time watching the Warriors and not getting annoyed. So I definitely am continuing to root against them, but not because they don't play a great style of basketball, just because of my bias as a Cavs fan.
Okay, so I guess this is probably also a good time to talk about, I mean, the flagrant in game one and then the flagrant tonight. Like, were they warrantable? Were they not? What do you think, Mike? I'll give you my take. I think Draymond's flagrant. I think that's a flagrant one. I don't think it's a flagrant two. I don't think he should have been ejected. I don't really like seeing ejections in the playoffs unless it's like horrendous. Now I think tonight's flagrant was way more vicious and volatile, and obviously, it did end in an injury.
It still doesn't warrant a suspension, though. I'm sorry, an ejection. I texted you. I said, oh yeah, Draymond definitely should have been ejected, but that's only because of my personal animosity towards Draymond, and then his reaction after it was just clownish. But if you really look at just that play, yeah, he kind of hits him in the head, and then yeah, he grabs the jersey, but he's trying to hold him up, and you can say, oh, he's just trying to make it look so he doesn't get suspended. Yeah, whatever. I just think that in a playoff game, when you're trying to prevent a layup, that play to me didn't seem definitely a flagrant one, definitely not worth an ejection. And then tonight's play, you can say that he wound up and that Brooks, sure, he whacks him on the head and Peyton goes down and he has an injury to his arm. I'm not sure yet. I haven't heard anything about what the seriousness level of that is yet, but I still find it hard to believe that that particular play is worth an ejection. He's swinging. Yeah, he ends up hitting him in the head. You could say, well, he doesn't really have a chance to hit the ball, but when you go up to elevate, you don't know exactly. That's part of what makes the game interesting, right? You don't know what the offensive player is going to do. You don't know where he's going to put the ball. You're going up to try to make a play, and then you take a hard foul so the guy doesn't get a layup. So I don't know. To me, neither one of those plays is ejectable. I don't want to see guys ejected for those kinds of plays. As you said, there's definitely a line. I didn't think either one of those plays crossed that line. I really didn't.
Yeah. Well, let's see what happens here. Oh, no. Oh, Draymond, you got to hold on to the ball, buddy.
Well, you saw Morant's shot, right?
Yeah.
You got 17 seconds left?
Yeah, they just called traveling on Clay?
Yes.
All right, well, I think it's about to wrap it up. That's put a bow on it.
Well, I wouldn't put a bow on it yet.
I'm putting a bow on it, Mike.
You're up four. Even if you make two, you're going to trade two for threes with Golden State. So we'll see.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Well, they're not up four. They're up three.
That's what I'm saying. But even if you make two free throws, you're still going to trade two for three because Golden State clearly isn't going to shoot a two after you foul.
So we're going to look at this. Let's look at it this way. Let's think about it this way. If Memphis wins this game, okay, series is 1-1. The other series tonight, 1-1. We could say, the home teams did what they were supposed to do tonight. They both faltered in game one. So realistically, if you're the Warriors and if you're the Bucks, you're probably like, well, good. Now we've got home court advantage, right? You walk away with this saying, we won one. We did what we needed to do. Now we go to go play at our place. And I mean, listen, Memphis playing in front of their home crowd and all that stuff is one thing. Going over and playing is the Chase now. They're at Chase now, not at Oracle anymore. Chase Center. Like, that's going to be a totally different thing. I think both of the away teams, even though they lost tonight, have to walk away thinking, okay, well, we did what we needed to do. Now we're going in to hosting games. We have the home court advantage. Agree or disagree?
I don't know. I agree theoretically, and certainly you want to come away if you're a visiting team and you come away with a split, even though, especially when you win game one, you want to win game two. Going home, you got to feel good about it. You've taken away the home court advantage from the higher seeded team. But yet, I kind of feel like, and I don't have the statistics in front of me to back this up, but it feels like the home court advantage is less meaningful than it's ever been. And that if you come in and you play well, that it's easier to win on the road, it feels like, now than it was 15 or 20 years ago. And I could be completely wrong, but I just look at it and I think, yes, when you talk about Milwaukee and Boston, Milwaukee defending NBA champs coming home 1-1, should they be able to win two games on their home floor against Boston? You would think so. You would think with the crowd behind them that they'd be able to do that. I don't know for sure, but I think, as I said with Milwaukee, to me, it comes down to how's Boston going to shoot threes and how's Milwaukee going to shoot threes. The three is such a, it's such a difference maker, and it provides such a variance from game to game that to me, that's what it comes down to, because both teams are going to sort of give up those threes for different reasons. Milwaukee's trying to wall off the paint against the entire Celtics team. And conversely, the Celtics are trying to keep Giannis out of the lane. So they're going to concede. Both teams are going to concede shots to the third, fourth, fifth option out on the floor. And if those guys make shots, it looks pretty good for your team. And if they don't, it doesn't. So you think about Boston in game one, shots don't go in. Things don't look that great. You talk about the game tonight, shots for Milwaukee don't go in. Boston's hitting everything. Suddenly, things look a lot different. And on this series, Memphis up 5, 13 seconds to go. If they finish this off, I have a lot less – I guess I would have – I have more confidence that Milwaukee – I'm sorry, that Golden State will win their two home games and go back to Memphis up 3-1 than I do Milwaukee winning two against the Celtics.
Golden State doesn't want to be up 3-1 because we know what happens when they go up 3-1.
Ah, nice. I like it. I like it. I'm sure they'd rather be up 3-1 than 2-2. Memphis 2-2.
Go ahead. Sorry. I was going to say predict. I mean, it's hard to predict this because we don't know for sure. I mean, I feel pretty confident that it's going to be 1-1. So, like, how do you think the Milwaukee Boston series goes 7? 6 or 7? 6 or 7?
It definitely goes 6 or 7. I don't think Milwaukee's going to win it in 5. I don't think Boston's going to win in 5 for sure. Boston's not going to win 2 in a row in Milwaukee. So I think the most likely scenario, man, I don't know. Milwaukee's 1-1. Giannis, I guess, had a really good first game. This game, he was, I'd say, average to below average. So you're going to get a big Giannis game in one of these two home games. And I think push comes to shove, I think Milwaukee wins these two home games. So I think Bucks in 6 is where I would land in this series right now.
Your first impression is everything when applying for a new coaching job. A professional coaching portfolio is the tool that highlights your coaching achievements and philosophies. And most of all, helps separate you and your abilities from the other applicants. The Coaching Portfolio Guide is an instructional membership-based website that helps you develop a personalized portfolio. Each section of the Portfolio Guide provides detailed instructions on how to organize your portfolio in a professional manner. The guide also provides sample documents for each section of your portfolio that you can copy, modify, and add to your personal portfolio. As a Hoopheads Pod listener, you can get your Coaching Portfolio Guide for just $25. Visit coachingportfolioguide.com/hoopheads to learn more.
Ja talking trash as he's walking off the court to Steph Curry probably isn't the best thing in the world. Just saying. Like, I don't know.
Ja was super clutch tonight. And for he's sure. Kind of proven that. Missed the game winner the other night on a really well-designed play and basically had almost the same shot that he made against the Timberwolves, a higher level of difficulty because he was coming in from further away and at a higher rate of speed and less time to get under control and make the shot, but still had that left-handed sort of spinning finger roll. And he's been really, really good in fourth quarters. Been average, I would say, for maybe even below average for Ja in the first three quarters of a lot of these playoff games. But in the fourth quarter, he's been really, really good. I'd be interested to see fourth quarter scoring in the playoffs so far. Ja's got to be right there at the top.
I've got some facts for you. All right. So he's got scored 47 points. It's the most of Grizzlies playoff history. Ja is averaging 31 shots a game in this series. Jordan's the only guy in the three-point era to average over 31 shots a game in a playoff series. So there you go. It's a fun fact.
Well, here's the thing. That they're their second best player in round one has been MIA in round two. Bane has been terrible. He had five tonight. And
I think he had eight on game one or something like that, seven.
They've kind of locked him up. Golden State has just basically said, we're not letting you shoot standstill jumpers. Go ahead and have at it and try to do something else. And he hasn't really been able to do much of anything. So you look at what Memphis did tonight. They have Dylan Brooks, starter, gets ejected after playing 3 minutes, scores nothing. Bane goes 2-for-7 and has five.
Is that the strategy from here on, Mike? Get a player ejected and you're going to win.
I guess. I mean, at this point, I look at it and I find it hard to believe that the Warriors are going to lose to Memphis. But Ja's been so good. And I think part of me feels like we're still perceiving the Warriors as the 2016 Warriors. And I don't think that this team is anywhere near what the 2016 Warriors look like from a couple of standpoints. Klay obviously is nowhere near what Klay Thompson was during the heat of the Warriors' championship run. He's not anywhere near the same player, both on his mobility on offense and his ability to defend. Steph, probably pretty close to apex Steph. Again, night in, night out. Sure, can he be below average some nights, but generally speaking, you're getting a similar performance from Curry. Draymond, say what you want. He's nowhere near as good of a player as he was during that run, especially offensively. I just think at this point, he's approaching Dennis Rodman-like standards of offense, where he did take 1-3 tonight. But for the most part, he doesn't even look at the basket. And at some point, the Warriors do lots of things to hide that, and they cut off him and dribble handoffs, and they screen and then screen again and try to get his guy into actions and take advantage of the fact that his player that normally would be guarding him out by the three-point line is now 15 feet inside the three-point line because they don't respect what he's doing. So they use him to screen, and then there's nobody there to help off the shooter. So I get it. And Jordan Poole has been tremendous, tremendous. But I still think that that team at its peak with Iguodala and Livingston and just all the guys that they had, not only in the death lineup, but just guys they could bring in off the bench, I feel like that team was a lot better. But I think we're looking at that at the Warriors, at least I am. I kind of keep looking at the Warriors through that lens, and that's why I'm maybe discounting Memphis's chances of winning this series. I find it hard to believe that Memphis is going to go in and win a game, but then I look and I say, if I look up and down the roster, I'm not so sure that the Grizzlies are deeper. They play more guys, and Ja is a different sort of player than Steph, but man, he's right there. He's right there in terms of what he's doing and what he's given his team. And tonight he was better. So I guess, are we going predictions? You want my predictions in these two series?
Yeah.
So like I said, I think Bucks in six. I think the Bucks win the two home games, lose game five, and then come back and win it at home. I think Golden State and Memphis, I think this series goes seven. My brain says there's no way that Memphis is beating Golden State, but it feels like this Memphis team, after that goofy series with Minnesota, I think I'm going to pick Memphis in seven.
Golden State.
No?
Golden State in seven.
Okay.
Golden State.
So you're saying the Warriors are going to win a game seven on the road?
Golden State in seven.
I think it's more likely Golden State in six.
Golden State in five, because if they go up 3-1, I mean, Memphis might cower in a corner.
I don't think Memphis folds. I think at this point, Ja's a proven commodity in a sense of
he's not going to get 47 every night, but he's not going to show up and lay an egg. He's going to show up. He's going to play. And
I'm going Golden State in seven. I'm going Bucks in seven. Both teams win on the road game seven.
Okay. All right.
All right.
So I got Bucks in six, Grizzlies in seven.
All right. Let's shift our attention to the other two series. I don't even know if I want to talk that much about the Philly series, Mike, other than the fact that it's apparent that James Harden is done. I'm over it. Mike, I'm over it. Ben Simmons in his fashion would have been more valuable on the bench.
Can I just revisit my original take for the trade again one more time? Can I just gloat?
Both teams lost?
So listening to Zach Lowe right today, and this is the second time on the pod that he's talked about it, that maybe everyone lost. I'm like, no kidding, Zach. I said that the moment that trade was consummated. Yeah, that both teams clearly lost. I mean, they both clearly lost that trade. Now you can say Brooklyn keeps Harden. He didn't want to be there, and he was going to pout and whatever. But
still would have been the
you
first
trade,
round.
You traded him and got nothing, and you still would have lost in the first round. And conversely, if you're Philly, you'd much rather have Seth Curry and your draft
DeAndre
picks.
Jordan.
and now this summer, you're really going to pay James Harden $260 million or what he's going to get over 5 years. It's insane. If they do that, that might be the single dumbest thing that any team has ever done in the history of basketball. That would be the dumbest contract that anyone has ever signed a player to, maybe in the history of professional sports. I'm dead serious. Like how could you possibly justify that based on what we've seen to this point? There's nothing. And Philly has, I mean, whatever the chance, whatever zero, let's go into the negative chances that they have of winning this series if Embiid doesn't come back. And then when Embiid does come back, he's got the thumb. Now he's going to be wearing a mask. You have the Embiid history of struggles in big games in fourth quarters as he gets tired and fatigue starts to set in. Miami's a mentally tough team. They have one of the best, if not the best, in-game coaches in Spoelstra. I could very easily see this series, especially if Embiid doesn't come back till game four, then they're going to be down 3-0. And that Philly crowd, if Philly gets down in game four, 6-2, that crowd's going to go crazy. And there's going to be some hearty boos raining down on the squad. And I could very easily see this series going 4-0 Miami very easily.
Yeah, and let's be honest, I would be okay with it. I don't need to watch. The less I have to watch Philadelphia play, the better, especially without Embiid. Like, at least if Embiid was out there, I'd at least have someone to enjoy watching play. But, I mean, this just goes back to – and listen, this was a freak thing, so, like, we can't even really blame Embiid on this one. Like,
I agree.
Like,
both of these injuries are not injuries that you would say – this guy's brittle. That's not what
I mean. He's got an orbital bone fracture and a concussion along with his ankle, right? So I just don't, or not an ankle. What was it? It's and his ankle's probably hurt too, but
it's his thumb. He's got his thumb injury.
I just don't see, like, if they go down 2-0, if they go down 3-0, there's no way you bring him back, right? You just be like, all right, we don't need to jeopardize his anything with him. Like,
I think you bring him back because he's going to be wearing the mask. I mean, I guess theoretically you could smash up your face more and you might not want to do that. His thumb injury, I don't think is at any risk of getting worse by playing. And I think if he's ready to go, they're going to throw him out there, whether they're down 3-0 or whether it's they're up 2-1. I think you throw Embiid out there and try to see what you can salvage. And Miami's good, but I don't think Miami is insurmountable. I mean, I think that whichever team wins the other series is going to beat Miami in the Eastern Conference Finals, whether it's Milwaukee or Boston. I would pick one of those two teams over Miami. That being said, I think that you look at this Miami team just is not a great matchup for the Sixers, especially without Embiid. And even when Embiid comes back, you got Bam in the middle. You got PJ Tucker to hound Harden. They got a lot of long, tough defenders. It's a team that is going to compete for 48 minutes, no matter who you bring out there and put on the floor. As I said earlier, Spoelstra's a good coach. I just think that Philly just doesn't have enough. I mean, their bench, they're getting nothing from anybody, any kind of substantial minutes, any kind of substantial production off the bench. It's just not happening. And you're asking Harden to carry a load that, quite frankly, he's not ready to carry that load as regular season James Harden. And certainly playoff James Harden is not ready to carry the kind of load that needs to be carried without Embiid. So I expect Miami to win this series probably 4-0. If Embiid comes back for game three, then Philly probably gets a split in Philadelphia and they end up losing it 4-1. But if Embiid doesn't come back until game four, they're going to get swept out by Miami. I expect Miami to move on to the Eastern Conference Finals.
You know, I think it's four, Mike. Four games. Done. And Miami didn't even play that good, really. Like, there were lulls in that game. Philly hung around, and then they just finished them off in the third
quarter. Look, I mean, Miami is starting P.J. Tucker, who I forget how many points did P.J. Tucker score in the Bucks run to the finals last year. He averaged like 2.7 points per game. And he's scoring a little bit more for Miami, but still. Then you're starting Butler and Adebayo. Great. Perfect. But Kyle Lowry's still hurt. You're starting Gabe Vincent and Max Strus, two guys who are basically street free agents and guys that Miami's developed, which they've done a really good job being able to do that. But, man, it's not an overwhelming team, but
yeah.
This Philly team is just not a good matchup. And without Embiid, let's face it, you take the best player off any team and it becomes a struggle really fast. So, yeah, I'd say 4-0 if Embiid comes back anytime after game three. And if he comes back for game three, then I'll give Philly one win in Philadelphia, and then that's it. It's 4-1. So Miami definitely moves on.
All right. Last series. Phoenix, Dallas. Listen. Luka was fantastic. They lost the game. And honestly, it wasn't, in my opinion, the score does not indicate how much Phoenix dominated that game. Dallas made a run at the end of the game. A great run, but they fell short. But here's my concern, Mike. You get a 45 point from Luka and you lose. I don't know, like, Booker's come back and at least been solid. He's not 100%. He's clearly not 100%. He doesn't look great. He looks good. I mean, he's still an NBA player. Ayton last night. Listen, if Ayton's going to make those shots he was making, like, and they're not going to defend, like, he had a few baseline, like, I want to say 10 footers. He had some good shots from, like, just inside the free throw line. Like, he's going to do that. I don't see Dallas, like, winning this series. And I know, once again, it's one game. We're reacting to one game. But Phoenix just looked like a better team yesterday. Do you agree? They just look like they're a better team.
I'd say Phoenix is definitely the better team. I think what you have to take away if you're Dallas is...
We have the best player?
We have the best player. We got off to a slow start in game one. And... then as we worked our way back and made that late run, we just could never get back over the hump to make it really a competitive game. As you said, even though it was seven, it never really felt like this outcome was in jeopardy. And Milwaukee-Boston tonight was somewhat similar, right? Boston jumps out to this big lead, bangs home a ton of threes. Every time Milwaukee got it to like 15 or 13, Boston would go on a 5-0 run or a 6-0 run, and then effectively, Milwaukee was back out of the game. And this Dallas-Phoenix game felt similar from that standpoint, that as Dallas tried to creep their way back in, suddenly Phoenix would hit a three or Phoenix would make some type of play that just kind of kept Dallas at bay. And as good as Luka was, you're going to need more help. Kind of like we talked about with the Sixers and kind of like we talked about with the Grizzlies, that you're looking at Reggie Bullock, 7 points, Dwight Powell, 4 points. Brunson only had 13 after he pretty much dominated that Utah series. So you're going to need more from the other guys in order for Dallas to win. And Dallas is going to have to play better defensively. They were a really good defensive team over the second half of the season, especially. And you can't give up 121 points, despite the fact that Phoenix is really good on offense. We know how good Chris Paul is. We know how good Devin Booker is. As you said, if Ayton's going to shoot the way he did, Bridges is coming into his own as an offensive player in addition to what he brings to the table on the defensive end of the floor. It's going to be tough for Dallas, and yet I still think that the history of the league tells you that more often than not, if you have the best player in the series, you're going to likely win that series. And it's not 100% fail-safe.
2015 finals, 2017 finals, Durant was the best player in the 2017 finals, sorry. 2015 finals, LeBron was the best player. He deserved the MVP in a losing cause. I will die on that grave.
I agree with that.
I
So look, it's sorry. Happened before. No, you're right. It's happened before. And I think in this case, it very well can and probably will happen again. But if you're Dallas, you still have to go back and think, look, we've got the best player in the series. They really had no answers for him. I don't know who you put on him. He outweighs Bridges by like 50 pounds and just can take him into the post and kind of do what he wants with him. Outside, he just has a way of slowly working his way into exactly the kind of shots that he wants to get. And he's such a good passer when you double team him that he renders that sort of irrelative. So I think just like we talked about with Boston, Milwaukee, if you knock down threes and you're shooting it well, you're going to give yourself an opportunity to at least be in the game. And Dallas went 16 of 39 from three in that game, and they outshot Phoenix, who only went 11 of 28. But yet Phoenix is so good from 2-point range that they were able to overcome that. And I think if I look at this series, I want to say, and I did say, I think, I don't know if it was last week that I said Dallas was my finals favorite. After watching game one of this series, I'm not 100% sure that this healthy Phoenix team can be defeated by the Mavericks. But Luka's so good that I'm not completely ruling it out, but I'll be surprised if Phoenix doesn't win this series. I'm going to say Phoenix in six. I'll give Dallas two wins somewhere here along the road and say Phoenix gets it in six.
Now, I'm going to completely contradict everything that I just said, Mike, and I'm taking Dallas in seven.
All right. Why? What's the reasoning? I'm curious.
Because Luka. I think he's just too good. And I think they're going to figure it out. I mean, Brunson played terrible yesterday. Kleber was great in the first half, and then they didn't do anything. Dinwiddie, I don't really get what Dinwiddie's role in any NBA team at this point is, because he just seems to not – something's off about him, and I don't know what. Like, I like the dude. Like, I like him.
I don't mind him as a player.
I just don't know if he fits in a winning team. I don't know. Anyways, I just, for some reason, despite the fact they have Jason Kidd as their coach, I'm going to pick Dallas. And maybe I just want to be contradictory, or maybe I just want to pick all the teams to win away on game seven, except for the, that's three teams I'm picking in game seven and to win on the road. And I don't know that that's ever happened in, I'm going to guess that's never happened.
I doubt it's happened.
So listen, maybe I'm just guessing that so that at least if one hits, I can say, oh, I got that one right.
That's right.
So that's where I'm going to go for now on that, Mike. So I guess at this point, we got to go finals favorite picks. Do we want to do finals picks then? I guess we have to.
Sure.
All right. Well, I'm sticking with Milwaukee, and I'm sticking with Golden State. I'm going there. I'm going to stay there.
Whew. So I guess my previous pick.
Your previous pick was Milwaukee and the Mavs.
Since I just said Phoenix is going to win that series.
You just said Phoenix wins.
Can I just change every week based on who's up and who's down?
You're getting to
be
like a politician here, Mike.
Yeah, I don't know. I go back and forth between, like, I guess, Milwaukee's still my pick in the East. I still think they're the best team. And who knows with Middleton when he comes back, if he comes back. But even without him, I think they can get through this Boston team. And as I've said a couple times, I'm not sure that I know what Miami is, but I don't think Miami has enough to beat Milwaukee. So I'm going to stay with Milwaukee as my finals pick in the East. In the West, I guess I just predicted tonight that the Suns and the Grizzlies would be playing in the Western Conference Finals. If that's the Western Conference Finals, then I'm going to stick with the home team and say we're going to run it back with Phoenix and Milwaukee.
Gary Payton II has a fractured left elbow.
Ooh. Yeah, it didn't look good when he landed. It wasn't like it pierced the skin or it didn't, completely go sideways, but it definitely looked like a pretty bad hyperextension. I'm not sure. He's been starting, and obviously what he brings to the table defensively, you're going to miss that, but it doesn't kill the Warriors in any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah, I'm staying with him. So, all right. So, did you say that you're taking Phoenix in the West then?
Yeah, I'll go Phoenix, Milwaukee right now.
Okay. All right. We'll see which. Mike switches to next week.
That's right. All right. Well, here. Let me say this. Let me ask you this question. So, what teams that are left do you want to see? Like, I'm looking at the East, and if Boston beats Milwaukee.
I'm rooting for – I can't root for Boston. God bless America.
That's what I'm saying. If Boston beats Milwaukee, I'm out on the Eastern Conference. I don't want any of those teams to win.
I mean, I guess I'll root for Miami, but I won't.
Yeah, that's probably where I would land. Yeah, but
your favorite player is on Miami. We haven't even thrown any Kyle Lowry shade because he's been injured.
I don't dislike Kyle Lowry as a player. I just – over time, prior to 2019, playoff Kyle Lowry was awful.
Yeah.
So anyway, I don't like any of those teams, I guess is my point in the Eastern Conference. And then in the West, my disdain for Golden State, we already talked about it earlier. I'm not really a huge Phoenix guy. So
the other two teams you'd be okay with?
The other two teams, Dallas and Memphis, if either of those teams made it to the finals and they were playing somebody other than Milwaukee, I would definitely be rooting for those teams. So I guess I have three teams out of the eight that I hope stay alive. And two of them are underdogs. Dallas and Memphis are clearly underdogs.
You didn't even talk about Philly.
I don't even have to go there. It's sad because Philly was my first non-Cavs team as a kid because of Doc. And I loved going back to the early 80s, I loved those Philly teams.
And I loved Iverson, man. I loved Iverson. Yeah, I liked
Iverson too. And so to root against Philly, it takes a lot. And all it really took was James
Santa
Harden.
Santa Claus, though. So let's come on.
All it took was James Harden. If James Harden ever gets traded to the Cavs, I'm out. I'm out for however many years he's on the team. Don't do it, Kobe Altman.
I don't think there's any way.
Don't sign him to a veteran's minimum contract this summer when Philly lets him go.
Yeah,
please don't do it.
Veteran's minimum.
please don't do it. Please don't sign him to a veteran's minimum. I'm begging you. I'm out on the Cavs when Harden comes here.
All right. What about when LeBron comes back?
He's going to be 56 when he comes back. Is that what's going to happen? Does Bronny have any kids yet?
No, he does not.
He's going to play with one of his grandchildren. Is that the plan here in Cleveland?
Oh God!
When he's a part owner, they're going to suit him up like Satchel Paige. Nobody's going to know how old he is. He's just going to go out there, hoop with Bronny and Bronny Jr.
All right, on that note, Mike, I think it's time for everyone's favorite segment. That's why they listen to this whole NBA podcast.
That's right. They just nobody's fast. Maybe they're just fast forwarding through all the NBA content just to get to the bad jokes.
All right, here we go, Mike. I got one. Why doesn't a photon need a suitcase?
Why doesn't a photon need a suitcase?
Because it's traveling light.
It's traveling light. I like it. That's a good one. Nice. That's good. That's a good one. That's a good one. How much does a chimney cost?
I don't have any idea.
Nothing. It's on the house.
Oh, that's a good one.
Why should you never marry a tennis player?
I don't know.
Because love means nothing to them.
How does a musician win a fight?
I don't know how.
They call for backup.
That's good. I like it. All right, those are four good ones. Put those in your arsenal, dads. Put them in your arsenal. All right, we're leaving it there. Those are actually four decent ones, I would say. Those are four pretty good ones. All right, so we have a Milwaukee Phoenix final in my mind, and in yours we have a Milwaukee Golden State final. I'd be okay with either of those. Come on, Bucks, keep it going. I want to continue to have a rooting interest in the Eastern Conference, and we will see where things go from here. Make sure you check out our interview episodes. We had a really good one that we released on Monday with Matt McLeod, and our episode coming up on Friday will be with, let's see, I just did his episode today, so I should know who it is. John Tharp, the head men's basketball coach at Division II Hillsdale College in the state of Michigan. Really fun episode. John's a great guy. You will really enjoy both of those episodes with Matt and with John. So please check them out. We appreciate you being a part of the Hoopheads podcast audience. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening. And we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast presented by Head Start Basketball.